Daniel. Daniel is a book that is daunting to preach. I've put it off now for almost 27 years. I've preached the Gospel of John twice and Philippians three times from this pulpit, and I haven't yet tackled the book of Daniel. That's not because it's a bad book. It's an awesome book. And it's a favorite of many. I mean, kids love it, right? It has a fiery furnace that men get tossed into. It has a disembodied hand that writes on the wall. It has another man getting thrown into a den of hungry, hungry lions. The pictures at Snacking Yak are going to be awesome. It has a vision of a man who rides on the clouds. It has a dream of a gigantic statue being smashed by a flying rock, and a visit of an angel with a metallic body, face like lightning, and a voice like thousands of people talking at once. It has visions of strange, mysterious, fantastic beasts. Daniel's where to find them. It's a unique book. There's nothing quite like it in your Bibles. It's classified among the prophets in our English Bibles, but it's in the writings section in the Hebrew Bible, the wisdom literature and the Psalms in your Hebrew Bible. It's got good history and amazing prophecy in it. It spans genres. There's nothing quite like Daniel. In the Gospel of Daniel, there are 12 chapters written in not one, but two ancient languages. Six chapters with six stories of dramatic conflict and contest in the highest courts. And then six more chapters with four major apocalyptic visions that explain the big plan of God for the world from the time of Daniel to the end of history. It's an awesome book. That's what makes it daunting. Who can do justice to this? Who can wrap your mind around it and show everything that's there, even most of what's there? It's daunting because it's so beloved. Because it's full of apocalyptic prophecy and obscure symbolism, it can be a very difficult book to interpret. It's tricky and complex and surprising. It's like the book of Revelation for the Old Testament. At least one of the books in the Old Testament that's the most like Revelation. I think Revelation quotes from it like 350 times or alludes to it. We just have to get ready right now to say from time to time, I don't know, and that's okay. Daniel can also be controversial. Not just with the people out there who have trouble believing in prophecy, that Daniel could be so accurate so far, far in advance, but also controversial among Christians who believe in Daniel's predictive power but disagree over what some particular symbols mean and how it all works together. In the course of this series, I may say some things that are new or different than what you've heard before if you studied it. And you may disagree at times with my interpretation, and that's okay too, at least on my end. There's some tricky stuff in here. If you don't think it's tricky, then that's another place where we disagree. I promise to stick close to the main thing as we go along and to show you what I see. We'll talk about the side stuff, but we're going to camp, as we always do, on the central stuff. I promise to keep the main thing as we study the book of Daniel. And we're going to study it starting today. I'm not putting it off any longer. And here's why we're going to dive in. Several reasons why. First, because it's next. Some of you are too young or too new to Lance Free Church, and you might not know that since 2003, we've been on a long journey of studying the big story of the Bible. We break it up by toggling to the Gospels and other parts of the New Testament, sometimes for years at a time, but we've also been trekking our way through the big story of the Old Testament, so much so that you can kind of track families by it, like Peter was born during Genesis. Right? And then we did Exodus and Numbers and Joshua and Judges and Ruth and 1 and 2 Samuel and 1 and 2 Kings. Remember the kings? A couple of years ago, we studied the prophecy of Jeremiah together. More of you will remember that since it was more recent, 2022 and 23. Jeremiah covers the same ground from a prophet's perspective as 2 Kings did in those books. And they both tell the story of the end of the kingdom of Judah and the exile of the people of Judah into Babylon. Guess where Daniel picks up? Right there. He overlaps with those stories as well. So it's what's next. And we want to study the whole sweep of God's word together as a church. Not just the easy bits, but the tricky bits too. But not just because it's next, but because we need it. We need the book of Daniel today. For one, we need the example of Daniel. We're going to see that clearly as we look at chapter 1 this morning. Daniel consistently shows us how to live as faithful believers during difficult times. And our times are difficult. There's a fun song that I'm sure the kids' Bible classes will be singing the next few months, Dare to be a Daniel. Do you know that one? Yeah. That's exactly right. But more and deeper than that, we need the God of the book of Daniel. We don't just need Daniel. We need Daniel's God. We need the God whom Daniel serves and Daniel reveals. Here's the title of our series: The King of Kingdoms. I want to thank Jeff Schieffer for creating the graphic design for this series. It's based on the Ishtar Gate in ancient Babylon, parts of which still exist today in museums. You can go and see the Ishtar Gate. It's this brilliant blue color. The Ishtar Gate was built by King Nebuchadnezzar, same one that Keegan just read about to us, during the lifetime of Daniel. So Daniel would have seen and probably passed through the gate of Ishtar, maybe every day on his way to work. Jeff has modified the design for our purposes. There's a lot of detail worked into there about things we're going to study as we go through this series. Jeff has recently retired. I don't know if we've publicly celebrated that or not. Congratulations, Jeff, on retiring. I'm glad that gives you more time to do graphic design for me. Just kidding, not kidding. The title of our series is The King of Kingdoms. And that has some layers of meaning, which we'll go into as the series progresses. But the big idea is that Daniel reveals to us the king over all kingdoms. And the kingdom over all kingdoms. And that king over all kingdoms is our God. And his kingdom will never end. Our first memory verse in this series is from the very middle of the book. Chapter 7, verse 14, the last chapter that's written in Aramaic, and the first chapter of the second half, which is devoted to the visions. In the vision of chapter 7, Daniel sees a mysterious figure, and he says, "One like a son of man, coming with the clouds of heaven. He approached the Ancient of Days and was led into his presence." That's what he sees. So this mysterious person comes into the presence of the Ancient of Days, God, the King of Kingdoms, and he is given a kingdom. The kingdom. Let's say now verse 14 together. Can you read it up on the screen? Read it with me. "He was given authority, glory, and sovereign power. All peoples, nations, and men of every language worshipped him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion that will not pass away, and his kingdom is one that will never be destroyed." We're going to drill that verse into our hearts and into our minds in the next few months, because we need it. We need him. We need the King of Kingdoms. Because it often seems like there is no King of Kingdoms. It often seems like the world is out of control. There's lots of kings, but it doesn't seem like there's a king over all kings. Doesn't it seem to you sometimes like the world has gone crazy? So much chaos, so much strife, so much change, so much out of our control, and so many things going wrong. Sometimes it seems like we've reached the end of the world. That's how it must have felt to Daniel when he was a young man. Let's look and see what happened to him. Something pretty terrible. Look down into Daniel chapter 1, verse 1. In the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. And the Lord delivered Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand, along with some of the articles from the temple of God. These he carried off to the temple of his God in Babylonia and put in the treasure house of his God. To Daniel, living in Judah at this time, this must have felt like the end of the world. Like that. Everything was crashing down. For over 100 years, the main world power had been the kingdom of Assyria. Assyria had actually defeated and exiled the people in the northern kingdom of Israel in 721 BC. But the southern kingdom of Judah has held on. They've successfully repelled Assyria whenever Assyria came knocking. But now the year is 605 BC. That's the date of verse 1. And there's a new world power on the ascendancy. It's the kingdom of Babylon. And their king was named Nabopolassar. And Nabopolassar has a son who is the general, the commander-in-chief in charge of Babylon's armies. And his name is Nebuchadnezzar. Fascinating character. And in 605 BC, at the Battle of Carchemish, which you may have learned about in your history class back in high school, Nebuchadnezzar wins. He beats the armies of Egypt that were allied with the remnants of the armies of Assyria. And Babylon effectively becomes the most powerful kingdom on the planet at that time. And right about that time, Nabopolassar died. And Nebuchadnezzar became the most powerful king on the planet at that time. And then he came after Jerusalem. And he beat him. He beat him good. He beat him into submission. Judah was still a nation with its own king, but they became basically a vassal state of Babylon, an under-nation under the nation. Nebuchadnezzar is the undisputed champion. And you know how we know? Because Nebuchadnezzar took the Stanley Cup home. The Vince Lombardi trophy. He took the article. It's much worse than all that. He took the articles of gold from the temple. Do you remember all the golden stuff inside the temple that Solomon built? We studied it in the Book of Kings. Gold plates. Gold utensils, gold tools for tending the sacrifices. You remember how King Hezekiah, when he was sick, showed the beautiful golden stuff to the emissaries of the king of Babylon when he was allying with them in 2 Kings? Well, Babylon has not forgotten what they have over there in their temple. Nebuchadnezzar takes those things from the temple of the Lord and puts them in the temple of his God. His God was named Marduk. Or his other name was Bel. If you see Bel and Marduk, they're the same god. B-E-L. The son of the god Marduk was named Nabu. And Nabuchadnezzar was named after him. Which god had won this contest? Careful how you answer that. Sure looks like Marduk has won, doesn't it? He's got the gold. But that's not what verse 2 says, is it? What did verse 2 say? Look at it again. And the Lord delivered Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand, along with some of the articles from the temple of God. The word for delivered in Hebrew is Natan. We get our name Nathan from it. Gift of God. The God of Judah gave the king of Judah to the king of Babylon. Do you hear me? The God of Judah gave the king of Judah to the king of Babylon. And the God of Judah gave the golden stuff to Nebuchadnezzar too, for safekeeping in Marduk's house. I've got 3 points this morning for us to apply this chapter of Daniel to our lives. Here's the first one. Remember who is the King of Kingdoms. We got to get this straight. The God of Judah, who we know as Yahweh, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, the God we worship here today, did not lose this battle. Seemed like it to Nebuchadnezzar. Take that, Jehoiakim. Says he put him in shackles for a time. It seemed like it to Babylon. We've got your gold stuff. We've got your gold stuff. Probably seemed like it to the whole wide world. It was all over the media that Marduk had beaten Adonai. And that Nebuchadnezzar was the king of kings. But that's not how it was. This was God's doing. This was God's plan. This was God's punishment on his people. Daniel doesn't dwell on it here, but this was because of everything we read about back in Jeremiah, isn't it? Jeremiah was a broken record about what? Do I have to preach Jeremiah again? A broken record about a broken covenant. For 40 years, Jeremiah called Judah to repent. 40 years! And they just stuck their fingers in their ears. No, 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 no. We're not listening. Jeremiah prophesied during the reign of 5 different kings in Judah. The first one was godly Josiah. And then the next one was named Jehoiakim. Was he thumbs up or thumbs down? Jehoiakim. Yeah, 2 thumbs down. Right? Bad king, bad shepherd. Jehoiakim was the one that burned the Bible. Do you remember that? Jeremiah 36. He had someone read to him from the scroll of Jeremiah's prophecies, and then he would cut it off and he put it in the fire to warm himself. And he didn't even have the temperatures we're going to have. The Bible. And finally, the Lord said, that's enough. And he gave Jehoiakim to Nebuchadnezzar. It's interesting to think of Daniel living through all of that. He had maybe heard Jeremiah preach. He was very young and Jeremiah was getting old, but they lived at the same time. They were contemporaries and they followed the same God. And that God is the King of Kingdoms, no matter how it seems. And that's good news. Because it really seems like there are all these kings out there and all this chaos, and it's good to know that there is a king over all the kings that is working out his wise and holy plan. The chief purpose of apocalyptic prophecy, listen to this, there's a key. The chief purpose of apocalyptic prophecy is not to give us all the details. It's to give us the big picture, to give us a right perspective. And that gives us hope and comfort and courage. But that doesn't mean it's easy. Just because we know and remember that the Lord is behind this defeat doesn't make it all better. Doesn't mean that it isn't scary. It doesn't mean that it won't get worse. Sure got worse for Daniel. Because it wasn't just the gold stuff of the temple that got carted off to Babylon in 605 BC. It was also the cream of the crop of the nobility of Judah. Look at verse 3. Then the king, that's Nebuchadnezzar, ordered Ashpenaz, chief of his court officials, to bring in some of the Israelites from the royal family and the nobility, young men without any physical defect, handsome, showing aptitude for every kind of learning, well-informed, quick to understand, and qualified to serve in the king's palace. He was to teach them the language and literature of the Babylonians. The king assigned them a daily amount of food and wine from the king's table. They were to be trained for 3 years, and after that, they were to enter the king's service. That's where I ask Keegan to read to, and where we get the title of this message, the king's service. These young men from Judah were selected to serve the king, literally to stand before him, meaning to be a part of his court, kind of his diplomatic corps, his royal administration. Makes a lot of sense. If you grab the cream of the crop from the nation that's under you and you train them in your ways, then you have a big supply of help that can speak both languages and know both cultures and help you keep the under nation in check. Smart. And verse 6 tells us that among those selected for this service were some pretty important names for us to know. Look at verse 6. Among these were some from Judah: Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. These four guys were selected to be trained to be in the king's service. Now, on some level, that doesn't seem so bad, does it? I mean, who doesn't like to be selected? Ooh, pick me, pick me. And these guys are obviously the elite. They're good-looking and smart, right? Got some good-looking and smart people sitting here in front of me today. They are the obvious choices for the team captains. And they get to be educated. They get degrees. They get to eat food from the king's own table. There are worse things. Some of their friends died in the battles with Babylon. Some of their friends are going to die in the next set of battles with Babylon. And some the next. In 597 BC, there will be more deportations. A guy named Ezekiel is going to be exiled. In 586 BC, Nebuchadnezzar is going to attack Jerusalem, and he doesn't leave a lot left. He destroys the temple. This time he didn't just raid the temple and take some of the gold things. He tore it down. And that's why we have the book of Lamentations in our Bible. That was about the worst thing that ever happened in the Old Testament from their perspective. That's how it felt. So Daniel's fate wasn't so bad, but think about it from his perspective. Daniel was taken far away from his homeland. Do you remember what our sermon series on Jeremiah was called? I'm really taxing your brains today. Anybody remember? Does anybody remember what the sermon series on Jeremiah was called? Can anybody read this? Uprooted. Daniel was picked up by the roots, and he's taken away from everything he knew. Daniel was a teenager, 13, 14, 15. If you're a young man of those ages, would you stand? If you're 12 to 17, would you stand? Do we have anybody here that age among us? 1, 2, 3, 4. Okay, moms, wave goodbye to them. You may sit, guys. Never see them again. And they never see you again. They were taken from their homes, and Daniel never returned. Daniel lived to be a very old man, but he will die in Babylon. He's marched 600 plus miles away and told that he has to go to school to serve the king who just beat down his kingdom. And he has to study things he doesn't want to study. What's on the curriculum? He has to study the language and literature of the Babylonians, literally the Chaldeans, which was an ancient name for the main ruling ethnic group of Babylon and their wise men. Doesn't get to study Hebrew. If he studies his Bible, it's on his own time. And there may not be very much of that. He has to study Akkadian. He has to speak Aramaic because that's their main language for court affairs, but Akkadian was their scholarly language. It has like 100 different stick figures that you have to memorize and be able to write. Cuneiform. He has to study astrology. Not astronomy, though that would be helpful, but astrology, how the stars rule our lives. Hint, they don't. But he's got to study it anyway. He's probably got to study divination. My daughter is learning how to keep cats and dogs alive as a vet tech. Daniel and his friends probably had to kill animals like sheep and then predict the future by what their entrails look like. Oh, I think it's going to be a good year because look at the size of this liver. Daniel had to study history, not Israel's history, but Babylon's history. And laws, not Israel's law, but Babylon's law. Had to read Babylon's books, not Genesis, but Enuma Elish and Atrahasis. He's got to learn all of that to be effective in the king's service. He's in bondage. And he's forced to attend Babylon University. He doesn't want to be there. He doesn't want to learn these things. And he doesn't want to serve this king. And on top of all that, they slap a new name on him and his friends. They had these wonderful Hebrew names that reminded them of the Lord. All their names kind of connect to the Lord. Daniel means something like, God is my judge. And Hananiah means, the Lord shows grace. And Mishael means, who is what God is? Azariah means, the Lord helps. But look at verse 7. The chief official gave them new names. To Daniel, the name Belteshazzar. To Hananiah, Shadrach. To Mishael, Meshach. And to Azariah, Abednego. Those names are tied to other gods. Belteshazzar, that's kind of like, some of these are hard to translate, but the God lady preserves the king. How'd you like that one as your new name? Or Shadrach is command of Aku. Meshach is who or what Aku is. Abednego is servant of Nego or Nebo. How would you like to be given a new name based on your enemy's God? A new identity, but not the one you would have chosen. It should also be said that these boys may have been castrated. The word translated court officials is often translated eunuch, and many, though not all, top officials and governments in that time period would have had that done to them. It seemed like Daniel's world had ended. But somehow, in all of that, Daniel remembered that the Lord was the King of Kingdoms. He never lost sight of who really, really was the king. He's got to serve this king, but all that time he never stops serving the King of Kings. It's truly amazing. It's astonishing. Wonder who taught him this. Maybe just God directly himself? Maybe some Jeremiah? Probably a godly mom and dad. Who knows who else? I know it wasn't Jehoiakim. The key is that Daniel never, in all this book, 12 chapters, he never forgets that the Lord is the King of Kingdoms. And he sets his heart on following that king no matter what. That's point number two. Resolve to serve the King of Kingdoms. Look what Daniel does in verse 8. But Daniel resolved not to defile himself with the royal food and wine, and he asked the chief official for permission not to defile himself this way. Daniel set his heart, that's what it means to resolve, to take his heart and to set it in a direction. He decided in advance, in his heart, what he was going to do and not do. He set his heart to not defile himself because he served a higher king. Now, it's not obvious why the royal food and wine would have defiled Daniel. Scholars have a lot of opinions on this, and there's some good theories out there. One is that a lot of this food would have gone against the law of Leviticus and wasn't kosher. It was unclean. But that probably wouldn't have been true of the wine unless Daniel had taken a Nazirite vow, and it doesn't say anything about that. Maybe it's because the food was dedicated to idols, like Marduk, before being served out to the king's table. And that's probably true, it was. But it was probably true of the vegetables as well. Some have said it's because it's royal food for the king. And if Daniel ate that, then he was making a covenant of unswerving loyalty to the king, like a covenant meal, fellowship. I think there's something to that. And others have pointed out that if Daniel eats this, then he's becoming completely dependent on the king and just giving up everything to rely on him. I think there's something to that as well, though all this other food that he does eat comes from that same king. It's not really clear to us. But it was really clear to Daniel. Daniel knew his conscience. And his conscience said that this would defile him. I think that's really important to see. I'm amazed that Daniel could discern what he could and could not do so clearly. Think about it. He was willing to be called by a terrible name. Okay, call me what you want. Notice that when they talk to one another, they use their Hebrew names. Okay, it's still in there. They still have both names. But you want to call me that? Okay. He's willing to learn all the stuff they wanted to jam down his throat. He was even willing to serve before the king. And he does that with distinction for decades. But this was too far for him at this point in time. And we all have to figure out what's too far for us. You know what really jumped out at me was that Daniel decided that what he wasn't going to do was to eat all the good stuff. He wasn't going to take the best of Babylon into himself. He was willing to do the hard part, but he wasn't going to do the easy part. That takes discernment, and it takes courage, because there was all kinds of pressure to conform. This whole program of re-education was to get Daniel and his friends to conform, to become Babylonians. And that's true for us today, isn't it? Do you feel in this time of chaos all the cultural pressures to conform to the world? We talked about this last summer during Family Bible Week in Romans 12:2, right? Do not be conformed to this age, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind, so that you may discern what is the good, pleasing, and perfect will of God. Just like Daniel, discern what he could do and what he couldn't do. There's all kinds of pressures to conform, but the most dangerous ones are the ones we want to conform to. The ones we feel like doing. The easy ones. The ones that all of our other friends are doing. Not the ones that the culture's jamming down our throats. The ones that look so tantalizingly good. Like gossip? The Ladies Fellowship Group has just begun a study of this book called Resisting Gossip. I've heard of it. It's okay. What does Solomon say gossip is like? A choice morsel. That's the thing you want to eat, right? From the king's table. Or we have our friends from the PRC today. Abortion advocacy. That's popular. It's super popular to be pro-choice. Who would be against choice and reproductive rights, unfettered access to elective abortion? But maybe that doesn't tempt you. How about nationalism? That idolatrous version of patriotism that says my nation over other nations, even if my nation is in the wrong. America first, America only, America right or wrong. USA, USA, USA. That's very popular and very tempting to some. Or dressing immodestly for both men and women. That looks so cute on you, the world says. And we just want to believe it and do what we feel like, whether or not it's modest, like God wants. Or what we watch on our screens. Ooh, that show looks good. What's it rated? Oh, well. Everybody else is watching it. It's so well done. Amazing production values. The best stars. For me, it's often the temptation to gluttony itself. I want to eat like a king. And maybe the line is at different places for different people. Probably is for some of the ones I just said. And we should not stand in judgment over our brothers and sisters. But we should be careful not to defile ourselves. We should know where our lines are and decide before we're tempted to not cross them. And we should know which of those things are tempting to us. Some of the things I just mentioned are not tempting to you in the slightest. If the culture is sending that message to you, you're like, forget it. I never even wanted that in the first place. What is tempting to you? What is Nebuchadnezzar's royal food and wine to you? Resolve right now to resist it. Resolve right now to not give in to the voices of the many kings out there that are offering you the best of Babylon. It's so easy. Just eat it. You love it. It tastes good. And resolve to serve the King of Kingdoms first and above all. Dare to be a Daniel. Now notice that Daniel resolves in his heart to not be defiled, but he doesn't get all huffy about it on social media. He doesn't whine and complain or despair. In fact, he's very respectful and courteous about it. He asks Ashpenaz for permission to refrain. And here's where we get the first miracle in Daniel. Look at verse 9. Now God had caused the official to show favor and sympathy to Daniel. You know what the Hebrew word for cause there is? It's natan, like verse 2. God gave. Gift of God. Here's something else God gave. He didn't just give Jehoiakim to Nebuchadnezzar. He gave favor. The Hebrew there is chesed, loyal love, and sympathy, compassion, to the official to show to Daniel. This pagan guy, his heart goes out to Daniel. You see, God doesn't just live in Israel. God is not confined to the temple of Marduk. He's actually working in the lives of his people and even in the hearts of his enemies. You and I can pray like this today. We can pray for favor with our neighbors and our coworkers and our bosses and even our enemies. And sometimes the King of Kingdoms grants it. Of course, the answer here is no, at least officially. His heart goes out, but look at verse 10. But the official told Daniel, I'm afraid of my lord the king who has assigned your food and drink. Why should he see you looking worse than the other men, young men your age? The king would then have my head because of you. There's the stakes. He says, I like you. I feel for you, but the answer has to be no. If you don't eat like a king, then you'll get all skinny and scrawny and I'll get into trouble. Be a Babylonian, Daniel. Eat like a king. But I see some wiggle room there. And so did Daniel. He didn't actually say no. He just said, I would get in trouble. There can't be a problem here. So Daniel asks the next guy down. He's the guard, or the Hebrew is Melzer, which other versions, older versions, take to be his name, which is possible. He could be a guard named Guard. Verse 11. Daniel then said to the guard, whom the chief official had appointed over Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, there's their Hebrew names, please test your servants for 10 days. Give us nothing but vegetables to eat and water to drink. Then compare our appearance with that of the young men who eat the royal food and treat your servants in accordance with what you see. So he agreed to this and tested them for 10 days. By the way, when you go to your supervisor, don't just take a problem, take a solution, right? That's what he did. And, by the way, this is the original VeggieTale. Daniel proposes a test. He's been taking a lot of tests these days in school. Here's another one. Come on, let us just eat vegetables. And the Hebrew there could include other things that are based on seeds, like grains, and water to drink. For 10 days, just 10 days. Let's see what we see. Now, this is not some secret biblical diet we're supposed to follow. Just Just like we are not supposed to make sure we get our recommended daily allowance of locusts, like John the Baptist taught us. Now, this is asking for a miracle. The healthy, wise men of Babylon were rotund. I read one scholar who said the wise men of Babylon, the ideal wise men of Babylon, was bald, big-eyed, and chubby. That's the ideal that Ashpenaz is going for. You don't get that way on vegetables and water. But the guard says, okay, don't tell my boss, but we can try it for 10 days. After that, you have to eat the good stuff if you're wasting away. And this is the point where we have to point out that this experiment might not have worked. I mean, we've read the story. We know what happens, right? But Daniel and his friends have not read the book of Daniel. They needed to be prepared for the worst. That's part of daring to be a Daniel, not knowing how it's going to work out in the short run. They might have lost their lives if they continued to play chicken with the king's chicken cacciatore. But that's not what happened. No, instead, there was a quiet miracle. Look at verse 15. At the end of the 10 days, they looked healthier and better nourished than any of the young men who ate the royal food. So the guard took away their choice food and the wine they were to drink and gave them vegetables instead. Here's our last point for today. Be rewarded for faithful service to the King of Kingdoms. Expect to be rewarded when you faithfully serve the King of Kingdoms. God was at work here. God's in control here. God is working in unexpected ways. Do you need to hear that this morning? He was rewarding Daniel and his friends for serving him faithfully above all others. And he continued to reward them. Look at verse 17. To these four young men God gave, Nathan, gift of God, knowledge and understanding of all kinds of literature and learning. And Daniel could understand visions and dreams of all kinds. That's going to come in handy. At the end of the time set by the king to bring them in, the chief official presented them to Nebuchadnezzar. The king himself talked with them, and he found none equal to Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. So they entered the king's service. In every matter of wisdom and understanding about which the king questioned them, he found them 10 times better than all the magicians and enchanters in his whole kingdom. And Daniel remained there until the first year of King Cyrus. Now we need to be careful to draw the right lessons from this. Not only are we not supposed to just eat vegetables, but we're also not supposed to expect to always be class valedictorians, top of the class. The reward for faithful service does not always come in the same way or in the same timing. Jesus was perfectly faithful, and he had to die before he got his full reward. So hang on. Wait for this expectation. Don't turn this into a prosperity gospel of health and wealth if you just do the right things and keep your nose clean. But at the same time, we know that the true king loves to reward his faithful servants. We live for the day when he says, "Well done, you." Notice that faithful service to the King of Kingdoms often looks like faithful service to earthly kings. God gave Daniel these gifts. Daniel was accountable for what he did with them. He didn't give the other three all the same gifts, just Daniel. And Daniel used them in the service of King Nebuchadnezzar, which says something, I think, about how we should view our earthly callings, our daily jobs, what you're heading into later this week. Daniel entered into the service of Nebuchadnezzar and then several other kings for almost 70 years, even a king that wasn't a Babylonian. But Daniel never lost sight of whom he was really serving. And may we dare to do the same.